So in passing this morning, I mentioned that it can often feel like the path of practice, that we're swimming upstream against the current, both in terms of the values of society, but also in terms of our own instinctual tendencies. So many of the systems and structures in place in society feel more aligned with greed and acquisition, with distraction, and cause so much harm to big groups of people. And we ourselves find ourselves in this tendency to push-pull with life, in conflict with how life unfolds. So the Buddha, one of the ways he talked about our experience and an area to explore in our experience is Vedana, which is usually translated as feeling tone. And we've mentioned it in passing quite a lot during this retreat. As part of any experience we have, there is this tonality of it being somewhere on the pleasant-unpleasant spectrum, the pleasure-pain spectrum. And we have a natural instinctual tendency to this pleasure pain that we experience as part of our everyday life, but also in our meditation, which is to want to push away the unpleasant and to actually pull at, to grasp at the pleasant. This tendency to want our experience to be only pleasant and to avoid all the unpleasantness. And it's important to realize that actually that pleasant, unpleasant doesn't reside in the actual object of experience. So, if Marmite was actually, Marmite's yeast extract, if it was actually as unpleasant as I think, and it resided in the Marmite, then everybody would find it unpleasant. But actually, contrary to my understanding, many people enjoy it and find it pleasant. So this aspect of Vedana, this feeling tone, is something that we bring to the experience. And it arises as part of every experience we have. And one of the things we find with this area of experience is that most, if not all of us, I'm loath to say everyone, but most of us have a very strong negativity bias. Our attention will automatically and habitually go to what's unpleasant in our experience. And another aspect of this negativity bias that the psychologists talk about is that how something that is pleasant needs to be 5 times as intensely pleasant as something unpleasant to actually displace it or to balance it out. And one of the consequences of this is that our teacher Rob Brebeer used to refer to this as joining the dots. So we have, I don't know if people remember or if they're still around actually or not, but you used to get these colouring books, and on each page there'd be a series of numbered dots which you join up to create a picture which you could then colour in. And we do this with our experience. We have an unpleasant experience, an unpleasant experience, an unpleasant experience, and we join up these unpleasant experiences and we have this perception or this sense that we've had a difficult day or we've had a stressful day. And we're tending to miss all the moments in between of ease or peace, simple joy of hearing a bird singing. They get ignored in this tendency to notice and prioritize the negative in our experience. And if we're not careful, we can start to join the days and the weeks and the months and quite possibly the years, and have this story of a life as difficult and stressful and miss all the other complexities of life, but all that complexity of life of moments of ease and joy, because they don't stand out to us. So the other really big insight the Buddha had around this whole process of Vedana is what he termed the fabrication of experience, how we build experience. So we start with this impulse of liking or not, of unpleasant, pleasant, this impulse of either pushing away the unpleasant, pulling towards the pleasant. And slowly we start to amplify that and exaggerate it. We start to identify with it. So someone says something unpleasant to us, and it's quite, you know, I don't like it. It's starting to become a bit about me. I'm taking it personally. I don't want this. Actually, they shouldn't be talking about me in this way. How dare they do this? How dare they speak about me like this? And before we know it, we're in an argument, a quarrel, a dispute. And if we look at the world, we actually see how this so easily leads to the violence and the wars that are present in the world. And we do this with all aspects of our experience, the views and opinions and beliefs we hold dear to, and so on. We can create and build these experiences in a way that they spin and can result in the conflicts we find in the world. But the Buddha also saw that there is actually a way to find freedom in this, to actually have the space to move against the stream. So like a swimmer, we can actually train ourselves. We can develop the muscle, the stamina, the breath that actually helps us meet these currents in life and actually choose a different path. And what I'd like to do is just articulate one way amongst the many ways this can be articulated that follows on from and expands something that Nathan referenced in his talk two nights ago, that comes from this idea of what he referred to as the Four Noble Truths, and in particular the four tasks in relation to those. So we have the first truth, that there is dukkha. And the task is to understand that and to embrace it, to actually be willing to welcome that as part of the human experience. And again, this is a training. This is that edge that we play with. Arising with this dukkha is this tanha that Nathan talked about, this impulse of pushing and pulling that puts us at odds with the world, this thirst for things to be different, which then so quickly spirals into reactivity. And the task in relation to this tanha is to release it, to let it go. Just to relax that contraction as soon as we become aware of it, as much as we can. Third truth is unbinding. There's this word in Pali that they use called nibbana, which literally means extinguishing, so to put out a fire. So when we're able to release the tanha, when we're able to let it go, we suddenly arrive in this space of possibility, a space where actually wise response becomes possible. And the task here is actually to know this space, to become familiar with it, to actually, if you like, develop that taste to want to dwell in this space more and more. And the fourth task is the path, to actually cultivate a path from this space. So the task is this development, this cultivation of, we might say, a wise life, a life of wise response. And this is articulated as the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path actually is a whole life path. It touches every aspect of our life. The views we hold, how we think about and imagine the world, how we speak, how we act, how we sustain ourselves in this world, how we sustain body-mind, how we stay present with our experience, where we direct our energy and how we use that energy, and how we collect and gather this together for the benefit of ourselves, others, and the world. And this path is an interdependent path. They all impact and influence each other. But also the Buddha said that actually wise view is the forerunner of the path also. Because he was very aware of the views and the beliefs that we have, how they shape our life, how they shape how we are in the world. So if we hold the unconscious view, let's say, that actually the world is dangerous, it primes our attention to look for danger in the world. We're always on the lookout for danger. And what we will start to notice is what is dangerous, which of course reinforces the belief. And we find ourselves in this circle. And they talk about this now in relation to social media, how the algorithms mean that people find themselves going around in the same loops of being their views and opinions being confirmed. They're never challenged because the algorithms are just getting them to look at more and more of the same material. They never see anything alternative. So we're invited to actually explore our views, our beliefs, both what are conscious, but very much so what are unconscious, and start to actually bring in views that help us, that are more supportive. And one of the ways that this wise view is articulated, there are many different ways in the tradition, but one of the most fundamental ways is as this, and old age and its consequences. So it was actually Sariputta who was one of the Buddha's senior disciples who was asked what wise view was. And he said, one who understands the unwholesome, the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, in that way, she is one of wise view. So, before maybe unpacking that a bit, it can be helpful to define what we mean by wholesome and unwholesome, particularly as in this society, this culture, and even if we haven't been brought up within a Judeo-Christian or Islamic tradition, we can very much bring a polarity to this type of thing of good and bad, right and wrong, pure and evil. But really what this language is pointing to is what we've been talking about all this week. The wholesome is what brings about well-being, what nourishes and supports well-being, but also what lessens suffering, to whatever degree, however small or large that is, what lessens suffering. So the unwholesome is obviously the opposite. It's what actually causes harm, or what increases suffering. So we're asked to understand this. So understanding it is being able to, in the first place, discern. So that clarity that can see, actually, is this leading to well-being or is it not? Is this lessening suffering or is it not? But also to start to actually really explore, as we have over these days, what's the consequences of each? What does it mean in my life when I respond to the difficult in a wholesome way? What's the consequences when I actually respond in an unwholesome way? And then, certainly the invitation from the Buddha is, actually, if you discover, as I discovered, that the wholesome actually is of benefit, it makes life somehow more joyful, more full of well-being, it lessens suffering, then can you put that as your highest value or one of your highest values? What your intention is to bring into your life and into the world. So just to say a little bit about this idea of the root of the wholesome and the unwholesome. So within the Dharma teachings, they talk about the roots of the unwholesome being greed, being ill will and aversion, and being confusion or ignorance. Ignorance in the sense that we ignore the consequences in terms of the wholesome and the unwholesome. We ignore the impact this has on ourselves and the world. So the wholesome is rooted in generosity, in metta, and in understanding or wisdom. And one of the senior teachers in this tradition, Christina Feldman, who actually is one of the co-founders of Gaia House, she talks about how we're always practicing something. In every moment of the day, we're practicing something. We're either bringing into being the wholesome, or we're bringing into being the unwholesome. We're either cultivating new ways of meeting our experience that actually are of benefit, that bring well-being, or we're actually reinforcing habitual patterns that often aren't very helpful to us. And of course, in the moment, it can often feel like we don't have much choice in the matter. You know, something hijacks our attention, and before we even know it, we find ourselves reacting and spiraling with it and actually causing ourselves or someone else harm. And this is why very much it's about cultivation. It's about training. It's realizing that for most of us, we've got very many years of actually practicing the unwholesome. And we don't get rid of the unwholesome just by deciding I'm not going to be unwholesome anymore. We don't get rid of it by an act of will. We actually replace the unwholesome with the wholesome. That's why we cultivate it. That the more we actually bring the wholesome into being, the more it actually becomes a naturalized default setting for us, the more it becomes our habit. In the tradition, they say that when the wholesome is present, the unwholesome can't be present. So when we're mindful, we're not distracted. The fact that we are mindful of distraction means we're actually still being mindful, because there's a bigger perspective. When metta is present, ill will can't be present. So we actually undermine the unwholesome through this cultivation and this development of the wholesome. And you might have noticed that really this whole week has actually been about this objective of cultivating the wholesome. In all the different ways we've talked about it, in all the different practices. The practice of mindfulness itself is a wholesome practice. To be present so that we actually know what's going on, so we can discern between the wholesome and the unwholesome. But also so we can recollect what our intention is, that our intention is to bring into being the wholesome. Grounding, meeting and welcoming our experience, spaciousness, are all wholesome ways of responding to what's arising in the moment. Developing the qualities of the heart that we've been talking about. So the quality of metta, of compassion, of appreciative joy that Nathan's going to explore later on in the afternoon. And this quality of equanimity, of balance and stability in the midst of everything. The ability to meet all things equally are all wholesome states, wholesome qualities that we cultivate and develop. Turning towards dukkha, so that we're actually including more and more of our experience, so this sense of welcoming, of inclusivity, is wholesome. And many qualities we cultivate, we don't necessarily cultivate directly. So patience, that willingness to come back again and again. Our attention goes, we find ourselves actually caught up in a harsh response to ourselves. We notice and we just come back as we release the tension. This is wholesome qualities that we cultivate as we practice. Resilience and resourcing. And courage, the courage to actually turn up and show up to our experience, to meet ourselves, to meet the world. Again, that's a quality, a wholesome quality that we actually cultivate, that we develop in our practice. And I'd also like to mention two practices that can be quite helpful as part of this whole life practice. One is a practice around gratitude that can really help with this starting to notice those moments in our days actually that are peaceful, easeful, that are actually have their own taste of a very subtle joy. So what many people do is at the end of each day, they recollect 10 things that they're grateful for during the day. And the object isn't so much to, you know, be able to find 10, but it actually the object is to start to incline the mind to notice during the day all those more subtle, more easeful moments, those moments of peace, those moments of relaxation, of actually being met by another person and being acknowledged. These moments that we can so easily overlook, so that we start to puncture holes in that tendency to join the dots and we get a more balanced view of our day. what it also does is it also starts to, if you like, start to rebalance some of that negativity bias. Because what we start to do is we start to pay more attention to those more subtle areas of the pleasant spectrum. Rather than, because of this tendency that it actually has to be five times as intense as a negative experience, our tendency is to associate happiness and joy as an intense experience. We're looking for something that's actually quite intense for it to register. So actually we're starting to tune into those more subtle aspects of our experience. So, yeah, this practice of gratitude is a real inclining of the mind to really notice those subtle, pleasant experiences that punctuate our day and so easily get ignored. We so easily just put them in that category of nothing much happening and overlook them. And another one is forgiveness practice. Both in terms of self-forgiveness, but also in terms of others. And it's important when we approach forgiveness practice that we realize that forgiveness is not about saying that something that happened in the past, something that was maybe done to us, was okay. We still recognize that actually it was unskillful, it was harmful. But forgiveness practice is about starting to say to ourselves, I no longer want to be bound to this. I no longer want this to actually take my energy, take my attention, to control my life. I want to actually start to release its hold over me. So just, we can do this, it can be a formal meditation practice, but we can also notice if there are areas of our lives where we have this, to actually consciously bring that sense of actually, does this help me holding on to this in this way? I acknowledge that what happened is not okay, but I want to start to release its hold on me, its impact on me. And the final quality I'd like to just say a small bit about is trust or confidence. As we engage with practice, as we over time notice how it is actually having an impact in our lives, how cultivating the wholesome is actually leading to more space in our lives, less reactivity, the ability to meet things in a more helpful way, a more beneficial way, that we find an increase over time of well-being in our lives, we develop a trust, a deeper trust and confidence in the practice, but also in our ability both to practice, but also to meet our experience. And this trust and this confidence, as it grows, is a really nourishing and really brings a real deep sense of well-being with it. Because it also starts to bring a deeper trust in life itself. So, one of the things the Buddha said about the teachings is that they can be like a snake. If we grab them at the wrong end, they'll turn around and bite us. So if we grab them correctly, behind the back of the neck, the teachings actually are supportive. And part of this imagery comes from in the days of the Buddha, they used to use snake venom as a medicine. So people would have to catch a snake to actually get some of the venom. So they had to be able to handle them in a way that they didn't cause themselves harm. And any teachings like this, with this idea of wholesome, unwholesome, practicing and cultivating qualities, it's very easy for us to actually start to compare ourselves, start to create another thing to beat ourselves up about, or something else, another idealized image we can start to try to measure ourselves against. So really being aware of that. And there's this lovely quote from a 7th century Chinese Zen master called Seng San, who said, "True freedom is being without anxiety about imperfection." So I'll say that again. True freedom is being without anxiety about imperfection. The human condition itself is limited. It is imperfect. Paradoxically, maybe that's its perfection. As Nathan says, it's okay to make a mistake. That's what we learn from. Again, we just bring ourselves back to our intention and do the best we can in the next moment. So I'd like to finish with a little poem as well, and it's also by Mary Oliver, who is a very well-loved poet amongst Dharma practitioners. And it's called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So, thank you for your kind attention, and we'll just have a minute of silence together, just settling back into stillness.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.